Good afternoon. I'm Greg Robinson. I'm professor of history at the Université du Québec à Montréal, or the University of Quebec at Montreal to the French challenged. It's my great pleasure to be called upon to be the moderator of this session, which is called The World War II Nikkei Experiences in the Pacific Rim, Hawaii, Latin America, and Japan. It is my distinct honor to present our three distinguished panelists. We will go in the order that it is indicated in the program, so I will introduce them in turn. The first is Ichiro Azuma, who is professor of history and the term chair at University of Pennsylvania. He is the author of Between Two Empires and of many other works. The second presenter is Franklin Odo. Dr. Odo, who is retired from being the Smithsonian Institution's ASIC Pacific American Center Chair, has taught at every institution in the world except for University of Washington, including stints at University of Hawaii, UCLA, University of Pennsylvania, Princeton University, and God knows wherever else. He is the author of No Sword to Bury, about the Varsity Victory Volunteers in Hawaii, and other works. Finally, the third panelist is Grace Shimizu, who is the chair of the Japanese-Peruvian Oral History Project and also of the Campaign for Justice, Redress Now for Japanese Latin Americans, and has been a longtime activist and leader in the movement for redress for the Japanese Latin Americans who were kidnapped and brought to the United States during World War II. So,
good afternoon. I think that the outline of my talk is going around, and I don't know who has it, but I prepare like about 30 of them, maybe run up. All right, but well, I have 15 minutes or so, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see. I'm in charge of talking about the Nisei experience in wartime Japan. But in order to have a proper understanding of that subject, I actually have to start with some discussion about why we don't know anything about them. Probably you don't know anything about them, right? So I'm going to start with that, and then I'm going to talk about why they ended up in Japan in the 1930s, and what kind of people, what kind of Nisei, that I'm talking about. And then I will talk about their wartime experience, and also the post-war experience as well. Let me start with that this first issue, why don't we know about them, right? And then, if you read the Japanese-American history books, most books don't even include their experiences. And that has to do with the couple of issues. There are more, probably, but I just mentioned two reasons why they're kind of erased from our historical memory or history. First issue is that the problem with the historians. Most of the historians of Japanese America do not really read Japanese language sources, okay? And then most sources are actually in Japan. So it's, for that reason, we don't know too much about them. Not much research had been done on the Japanese Americans in wartime Japan. Another issue is a bigger issue, I think. This sort of a group has been sort of a taboo in the Japanese American history because, Japan was, during the war, enemy, right? And they're in Japan. For the reason I explain later, they had to actually collaborate or sort of participate in Japan's war effort against the United States. So they became traitors, right? And they became the sort of a traitors of the traitor or the disloyal of the disloyal. And so they had to kind of live with that label, so to speak. And of course, that the Japanese-American history, especially before the success of redress, did not want to talk about them, right? And that still continued. And then combined with this sort of research issue, I talked about language issue, right? And then, they're completely kind of gone out of our memory and also the historical discourse we have in the community. So, but then this idea about the Nisei in Japan as traitors or the disloyal, I like to actually call into question this sort of a notion in and of itself. And as a course of my discussion on them, their experience, I like to show that, it is why it's wrong to just see them as traitors or the disloyal. Or maybe in the end, I like to actually propose this sort of a new way of looking at Japanese-American history, kind of do away with this idea of loyalty or disloyalty, or even, you know, so that's the kind of conclusion I like to get to, okay? Now, let me then talk about the prehistory of wartime Nisei experience in Japan, which has to do with the 1930s. Why did they end up in Japan? And then, you know, who are they? And then how many of them? So forth, right? Now, I say there are two groups of Nisei in pre-war Japan. One group estimated between 40 to 50,000 of them living in Japan, mostly rural Japan. They are the ones who actually went to Japan with their parents and mostly grew up in Japan and educated almost completely in Japan. So they are, you know, but they still are legally Americans or dual citizens, okay? But in terms of their acculturation, language, and also, you know, consciousness, they are pretty much Japanese because they grew up in Japan since their childhood and so forth, right? And then, you know, some expert estimated their words, you know, between like 40 to 50,000 of them in pre-war Japan, mostly rural areas, what's called the emigration prefecture, like Hiroshima, Yamaguchi, Wakayama, Okinawa, and so forth, okay? That's one group of Nisei in Japan, pre-war Japan, and also the wartime Japan as well. Now, the second group would be the sort of a main group that we kind of deal with, I guess. You know, there are students and also the professional types, okay? And most of these people were educated in the United States, and they went to Japan in search of some kind of heritage education to learn language of their parents. And then there are also highly educated Nisei who looked for the job opportunities in pre-war Japan because they could not find any job, good jobs, in the United States, right? You know, even if they had the master's degree in engineering from Stanford University, most of Nisei ended up selling fruits and vegetables at the, you know, sort of, you know, that stores are owned by them, right? They had to kind of stay in the ethnic economy because of the racism before World War II. The education didn't really mean much. However, they could find wonderful jobs in Japan because Japan was actually expanding and building new industries and so forth, and they actually, you know, Japanese wanted to get the sort of, you know, that the most advanced American sort of knowledge and technology through these highly educated Nisei. So Nisei, you know, paradoxically, highly educated Nisei could find better job opportunities and better lives, in a way, in Japan during the 1930s. Okay, so, you know, there's no statistics, but there are probably several thousands of them living through, mostly in Tokyo, but also there are a bunch of Nisei also living in Manchuria, Korea, and so forth. Judge Iso, for example, actually worked in Manchuria, right? You know, before the war. And so, you know, and also in the U.S. side, this for the same reason, like, you know, Min Yasui, you know about him, right? He actually worked as a, you know, lawyer for Japanese consulate in Chicago, right? You know, so you see that how discrimination actually worked against that highly educated Nisei. And some of that highly educated Nisei actually ended up in Japan. Not because they embraced Japanese imperialism, but because of the American racism, right? And they became sort of immigrants, so to speak, to the land of their, you know, ancestral land, so to speak. So, you know, here you can sort of already see that this idea of Nisei in Japan, pre-war Japan, or wartime Japan, being sort of a traitor or disloyal, this is kind of, you know, simplistic, right, in a way. But, you know, but here the point is there are two groups of Nisei in pre-war Japan. One, you know, the one is like mostly kind of grew up in Japan and educated in Japan and so forth. Consciousness-wise, they are mostly Japanese. But another group, several thousand student types, U.S. educated, and also the professional types. Okay, the bunch of also a journalist, like Bill Hosokawa, for example, you know, Mr. JSEL. He actually worked for Singapore Herald, which was actually Japan's propaganda newspaper, you know, but he was lucky enough to get back to the United States before the attack on Pearl Harbor. But those who did not come back were stuck in Japan and became disloyal, right? So that's sort of a, kind of side story. But anyway, so that, you know, those are the kind of Nisei who lived in Japan before the war. Now, toward the end of 1930s, things got pretty rough and difficult for many Nisei, partially because of the Japan's militarism and also the policy of conscripting, the Japanese citizens, right? And then many of that those Nisei who had worked and lived in Japan and pursuing education in Japan, they are also dual citizens. So they are subject to the conscription now. And after 1937, Japan escalated its invasion in China. So Japan, the Japanese army needed more manpower, so to speak, right? So a lot of, Nisei now face, Nisei men with dual citizenship now face the possibility of being conscripted into Imperial Japanese army. And that created the kind of sort of exodus of professional or student types to the United States, okay? And a lot of Nisei wanted to get out of Japan to avoid the conscription into Imperial Japanese Army, right? And another issue was that as the Japanese ultra-nationalists and also the militarists, increased their control over the Japanese politics and society, many Nisei, were subjected to the social persecution, so to speak. Because in the eyes of nationalists and also the militarists in Japan in the late 1930s, Nisei symbolized sort of materialism and Americanism that Imperial Japan wanted to stamp out or got rid of, so to speak. So that the Nisei faced all kind of sort of social persecution, sometimes even violence. Some story, according to some stories, you say Nisei women, students, they kind of got together, and then started talking to each other in English, of course, that's their language, right? But then some Japanese guy got so pissed off, basically, and then beat them up, basically. And that's the kind of story you actually read in the newspapers and so forth. So that's the situation where the many Nisei found themselves. Especially, those who had been educated in Japan, no problem, right? They're pretty much like Japanese, but the second type of Nisei I talked about, highly educated and also the student types, it became very difficult for them to be in Japan. So a lot of people started to leave for the United States after 1938. But there are also those Nisei who could not leave or did not leave because of family connections and employment and so forth. For example, again, because of American racism, which denied the entry of Japanese nationals after 1924, some of these professional Nisei, they're married to Japanese nationals. But then for them to return to the United States, well, that they could come back because they're American citizens, but their spouses could not come back because could not come with them because they're Japanese nationals, right? So, then the choice is kind of difficult, right? Most people actually chose family over the possibility of all kind of difficulties and so forth. So, there was exodus of Nisei from Japan to the United States, but also the people who were stuck in Japan for various reasons, other than their embrace of political ideology per se, right? Again, here, the idea of these people as disloyal or treacherous to the United States, this is too simplistic in a way, right? Now, during the war, these people are stuck in Japan, right? And then, in a way, Japan and the United States sort of acted similarly in the treatment of Nisei. U.S., you probably know about the loyalty question and so forth, right? United States put a bunch of West Coast Japanese Americans into the camp and then tested their loyalty, right? So basically imposed that, government version of loyalty and disloyalty upon the Nisei, right? And if Nisei did not go along with the government definition of being loyal, then they are labeled as disloyal, right? Now, Japan did the similar thing in a different way. That the Nisei in Japan faced the pressure to be Japanese and Japanese only. Show that the undivided, uncompromised, undiluted allegiance to Japanese nation state and empire. Okay? In the Japan's case, higher police oftentimes used violence to force Nisei to convert to Japanese citizenship and to give up the American citizenship and so forth, right? And after that, of course, if you're a man, then you would be conscripted into Japanese army because you are Japanese citizens, right? And then if you're women, well, oftentimes women are conscripted into some kind of sort of propaganda work. You know about Tokyo Rose, right? It was not really her choice. She had to do it, right? There's no other possibility. The state could cut off that ration, for example, right? You know, so that, again, here, I like to call into question the notion of these people as disloyal, in a way, right? So, you know, but that's the experience. They didn't really have much choice, so to speak, in terms of doing anything else but sort of a cooperating with Japan or Japan's war effort against the United States, so to speak. Now, after the war, quickly, it's almost over, right? Well, paradoxically, many Nisei in Japan actually found a job opportunity with the U.S. occupation because of their language skill. Just as in the pre-war and in the wartime, you know, period, the Japan actually found the usefulness in terms of the Nisei because of their language skill in the propaganda and so forth, right? But then after the war, the Nisei in Japan could find the job opportunity in the occupation. But they had to deal with the citizenship issue. Most of these Nisei actually lost U.S. citizenship because of their military service under the 1940 Nationality Act, U.S. Nationality Act. And some people actually voted in the 1946 democratic election in Japan. But the many Nisei actually thought that was a way to actually cooperate with America's effort to democratize Japan. And you know, but by voting in the foreign election under 1940 Nationality Act, these Nisei also lost U.S. citizenship. So many people actually could not come back because they are no longer U.S. citizens, right? So, you know, so most of the Nisei actually remained in Japan and then lived as Japanese. And that's part of the reason why we don't know anything about them, because they became Japanese, right? But then, this is conclusion. Now, I think that they should be included into the Japanese-American history, right? But for us to do that, I think we have to first do away with notion of loyalty and disloyalty to measure the one's, membership in Japanese-American society, right? At the same time, I think that we should do away with this idea of citizenship as a way to define Japanese-American identity and then also the membership in the community and the history as well. Otherwise, these people won't belong to Japanese-America, right? Because they are no longer Americans. But then it's not simple choice that they made, right? But so that's, I guess I have to end now. Okay. So that's what I had to say.
Hello, everybody. You want to stand up and shake a leg or something? I know post-lunch stuff is not easy. So I guess the thing about Hawaii and being Nikkei in Hawaii, the major issue for most of us is how does the entire West Coast population of Nikkei get incarcerated, and only 1,000 out of 160,000 people in Hawaii get put away? So what's the difference there? And we probably have some anecdotal kinds of issues that we bring up. But let me see if I can give you some of my thoughts that I've generated over the century the half century that I've been around trying to think about this. I'm older than I look. So I guess first the first thing I'd say is I'd steal from Eiichiro's title, Clash of Empires, that certainly since the early years of the 20th century, both Japan and the United States had a sense that they would come to blows in the Pacific at some point. In fact, in the early 1900s, the United States military characterized Japan as country orange. And so when they had war games, they would they don't have to indicate that this was Japan they're talking about, but indicate by the color orange. So by 1905, for example, Hawaii had been overthrown and annexed by the United States. Parenthetically, by the way, this is not counted in the time. The United States Congress has expressed regret, you've heard about redress now throughout the conference, but the United States Congress has expressed regret or apologized 5 times for acts in our country's history. Once obliquely for slavery, another time very tangentially for our maltreatment of Native Americans. The only time that we've provided redress, reparations, is for the Japanese-American World War II experience. And the fifth time was in 2011 and 12, very recently, for the Chinese Exclusion Act. That's an interesting story in and of itself. Well, in Hawaii, by 1905, the Japanese-American population was over one-third of the population, and nearly one-half of the workers, certainly in the sugar plantations. So the Nikkei population was, A, needed by the white planters, the Haole planters, at the same time as they were despised for their race and nationality, certainly exacerbated by the 1909 and 1920 major sugar plantation strikes. The Nikkei population was also faced with an ambivalent relationship with Native Hawaiians. Even by 1900, for example, the Hawaiian population had decreased from maybe 400,000 before contact to less than 40,000. The literal definition of decimation. But for the Issei workers, there was both antagonism and camaraderie, because rather than being in proximity to the Haole owners, they were very much in communication and proximity to the Native Hawaiian population. So as one example, in 1900, there was a massive Japanese publication called Shin Hawaii, New Hawaii, by a man named Fujii. And at the end of his 600-page volume on the Japanese in Hawaii, he included a trilingual dictionary, Japanese, English, and Hawaiian, which I think would surprise many people. Then third, there was, from the rest of the workers on the sugar plantations, at least suspicion and certainly some hostility from other workers, partly due to the rising nationalism and racism from the Japanese population, who were succumbing to propaganda from their homeland. So, for example, if you recall, there's a Sino-Japanese War in 1894-95, partly over control of Korea, which gets implemented in the early 1900s. So the colonization of Taiwan and Okinawa, for the Issei, respect came about to some Darwinian kinds of issues of power and respect internationally. And so for Filipinos, for example, these people were yabanjin, barbarians who were not up to snuff in terms of the ways in which Japanese were performing with relationship to the Western world. And finally, the Nikkei population was dismissed by its own government, so that they were sometimes called not imin or immigrants, but kimin, or rejected peoples, when they went to their own government for support, when they were protesting conditions on the plantations, for example, they were routinely rejected by the consul general there. So during World War II, then, with this background, it's a little bit easier to see that while Washington was calling for the mass incarceration of the entire Japanese-American population in Hawaii, for some really interesting, complicated reasons in Hawaii, the military and civilian leadership there conspired to basically send about 1,000 people to camps on the mainland as a way of scapegoating a few people in order to keep the mass population free to work in Hawaii. And, of course, you had the Nisei who were called into action right after Pearl Harbor in the Hawaii Territorial Guard, pulled out of the Territorial Guard in 1942 and considered 4C enemy alien until a year later in January of 1943. The 100th, you remember, the 100th Battalion was activated in June of 1942, trained in Wisconsin at the same time that people were being interned on the mainland. In the meantime, on February 25th in 1942, about 160 University of Hawaii ROTC folks were left campus for Schofield Barracks to work in the Varsity Victory Volunteers, a year in which they contributed hard labor and served as a propaganda vehicle, basically, as a major strategy to prevent race riots in Hawaii and stability in the post-war era. It's really sort of an interesting thing to think about that even before Pearl Harbor, some of the major civilian and military leaders were thinking about how in the event of war with Japan, the large Japanese-American population would be safeguarded to a certain extent so that no race riots would occur and that the post-war era would see some stability with regard to this population. So maybe I'll end with one other consideration. Why no concentration camps for the Nikkei in Hawaii? Perhaps martial law. On December 7th, in the early afternoon, the military declared martial law in Hawaii. And martial law, this is sort of an interesting topic that I think nobody has actually looked at very closely for quite a long time. Martial law existed in Hawaii from December 7th, 1941, into October of 1944. This is the single longest period of martial law exercised, implemented in American history. In some respects, it had some of the harshest policies. Even considering martial law that Washington imposed in the South during the Civil War. So this is a very interesting kind of datum. So it may be that the mass incarceration of 160,000 Nikkei was unthinkable for the war prosecution. I will have to tell you, one of the ways in which the Washington tried to implement mass incarceration was to suggest that maybe 160,000 of us, I say us, I was 2 years old in 1941, but was to move everybody to the island of Molokai. Molokai today has maybe 6,000 people. So can you imagine 159,000 of us on Molokai? And then somebody got the bright idea, well, now suppose the Japanese Navy invaded Molokai and liberated, quote-unquote, 160,000 really, really angry Japanese-Americans. Anyway, you get the drift. Thank you.
Okay, I was afraid of this. I didn't wear any high heels, so I wasn't sure if I could see over or if you could see me. Can you see my mouth move? Okay. On behalf of the former Japanese Latin American internees and our families, I want to thank the organizers of this conference for the opportunity to share our wartime and redress experience. But before I start, I just wanted to ask you in the audience, how many of you already know something about the internment of Japanese Latin Americans before you came to this panel? Can you just raise your hands? Ooh. Well, I want to thank you. And I'm glad that you know about our story. And please tell our story to others, because it's not being taught in the schools. We rely on you to help keep our story alive by word of mouth, talk story. Every opportunity to share our story is significant, because our experience has not been recognized as part of the history of this country, nor has our experience been integrated into our community's history, both Japanese American and Latino communities. Our story is all too often an unacknowledged or marginalized part of our Nikkei community's history. Every opportunity to share our story is precious, because our family members who suffered war crimes at the hands of the U.S. government, so many have passed away. Time is running out, and the Japanese Latin Americans have not received proper apology nor justice. And every opportunity to share our story as part of the World War II Japanese American internment and redress history is so timely and relevant, not only for our Nikkei community, but for our whole nation. Never before has there been such a need to have dialogue and draw lessons from our past so that we can better meet the challenges we face today in the aftermath of 9/11 to defend our Constitution and our democracy while protecting the security of our nation. My father was a Japanese national residing in Peru who was among over 2,200 men, women, and children of Japanese ancestry who were kidnapped by the U.S. government from 13 Latin American countries and interned in concentration camps in the United States during World War II for the purpose of hostage exchange. I didn't understand the significance of my father's wartime experience until I began to work with the Japanese Peruvian Oral History Project, which was established in 1991 by six Japanese Peruvian families living in the San Francisco Bay Area. Through our work, we learned more about what happened to our families, how the U.S. government initiated and orchestrated a Latin American rendition program. We also learned how the historical experiences of Japanese Americans and Japanese Latin Americans of immigration, internment, resettlement, and redress are intertwined. We share a common history and common struggle for empowerment, truth, and justice. We Japanese Latin Americans and Japanese Americans, we are both part of the Nikkei community here in the U.S. Japanese Latin Americans, I'm going to call us JLA, is to shorten it, share many similarities with JA families because of our immigrant roots. But we have a unique difference, too, because our families came to the U.S. by being kidnapped by the U.S. government. During World War II, we were rounded up and forced behind barbed wire fences. And with our JA counterparts, our families committed no crime. We were no threat to national security. There was no military necessity to justify the civil and human rights violations that were perpetrated against us. JLAs became part of the Japanese American community while being interned in camp. Our JA and JLA families live side by side in the Department of Justice concentration camps. And we were both used as human pawns in two hostage exchanges during the war. Over 2,800 persons of Japanese ancestry were exchanged, and of these, over 800 were JLA internees. And during the resettlement years after the war, JAs and the remaining JLA families struggled to reestablish our lives. We were both released from camp, and many JLAs became part of the JA neighborhoods and married into JA families. But the JLAs were classified as illegal aliens, and we carried that burden into the 1950s when immigration laws were changed. When we realized the integral relationship between JA and JLA experiences, when these two parts are put together, we begin to realize there is a bigger picture. What many of us have known as the World War II JA experience is now put into a broader international context of mass relocation, internment, and forced deportation of persons of Japanese ancestry. They show a shocking picture of how the U.S. government initiated and orchestrated a program of massive civil rights violations, war crimes, and crimes against humanity spanning two continents before, during, and after World War II. JAs and JLAs, we lost years of our lives because the U.S. government accused us of being potentially dangerous enemies. The impact of these violations has been long-lasting in our communities and continues to hold current-day significance for our democratic institutions and freedoms. JA and JLA families also share the struggle for justice, for redress, for government accountability. JLAs participated in the commission hearings, and we were included in the commission report. In 1988, both JAs and JLAs applauded the passage of the Civil Liberties Act. Today, we've come together to recognize, celebrate, and learn more about the role of and contribution of Nikkei activists in the redress struggle, highlighting the historic passage of the CLA. What a challenge I have felt to bring the vantage point of the JLA internees to the discussion, because our vantage is the ongoing redress struggle, the continuation of the redress struggle from the World War II period into the aftermath of 9/11. Our reality is grappling with the gains and shortcomings of more than three decades of redress struggle, a struggle which is not only for justice and government accountability, it has been and continues to be a struggle for truth and historical accuracy, a struggle against the suppression or marginalization of our history and its integration into the mainstream and Japanese-American community narratives. Our reality is facing both the strengths as well as the limitations and negative impact of the Civil Liberties Act, especially the decisions to deny JLA's redress under the CLA. Our reality is finding the strength and stamina to keep standing up to the U.S. government for what was done to our families, while realizing that today history is being repeated and other families and communities are enduring even more severe constitutional and human rights violations under the war on terrorism. These violations took place over 70 years ago, and we've been arguing with the U.S. government for over 30 years. The JLAs have filed five lawsuits. We lobbied for two pieces of failed legislation. We have not found justice in the U.S. courts, in the halls of Congress, nor in the White House. I'm angry because it's now clear the U.S. government wants rendition. The U.S. government, whether under Republican or Democratic administration, wants to be able to go to other countries, kidnap their citizens and residents, subject them to indefinite imprisonment under military custody, use them for whatever purposes, and hopefully they will be released alive. That's rendition. After 9/11 and the so-called War on Terror, we realized that the JLAs went through World War II-style rendition. And now, besides angry, I'm also scared. With the passage of the National Defense Authorization Act, the NDAA, in 2012, President Obama and the Congress have enshrined into law the same powers that characterized the World War II incarceration of Japanese Americans and the rendition and internment of Japanese Latin Americans. Under the NDAA, which is law now, the President of the United States can authorize the U.S. military to seize any person who it suspects of being a terrorist, any person, whether a U.S. citizen or foreign national, from any place in the world, whether inside the United States or from other countries, and imprison them in military custody indefinitely without charge or trial. The entire United States is now considered a battlefield in the war on terrorism, and our civilian judicial system is now subordinated to military jurisdiction. I now have a better sense of the fear, the terror that our own Issei and Nisei felt and lived through. I now feel that fear because I am afraid of my own government. I'm afraid of what the U.S. government is doing to other communities and that these policies and actions like the NDAA will be turned against our own community, our activists, on every one of us in this room. The NDAA is a slap in the face of the Japanese-American community. The Civil Liberties Act of 1988 was an apology to our community for a mistake that wasn't supposed to be repeated, and it was intended to make the U.S. look more credible when it criticized other nations for committing human rights violations. So what does it mean to our Nikkei community that the government violations suffered during World War II are now legal? It calls into question the sincerity of the Civil Liberties Act with respect to our community. It calls into question, what are we doing to stop this gutting of our Constitution? And in the face of this challenge, we'd like to make a call to action to our community, to you. First, we ask, defend our Constitution. Stop the NDAA. The NDAA gets passed every year. So we'll be facing this challenge every year unless we can repeal the unconstitutional sections or have them struck down in the courts. So let's join the growing national movement to stop the NDAA. Let's support congressional efforts to repeal those sections of the NDAA which violate our Constitution and international law. Let's support local resolutions to city and state government to resist compliance with those unconstitutional provisions of the NDAA. At this year's Day of Remembrance commemoration in San Francisco, attendees signed a petition urging the San Francisco Board of Supervisors to pass a resolution to refuse compliance with the NDAA. 2 weeks later, San Francisco became the 18th city to go on record in opposition to the NDAA. We also ask you to talk to everyone you know about the dangers posed by the NDAA. This is grassroots education and mobilization. But please be sure to include an important talking point. The incarceration of Japanese Americans and the rendition and internment of Japanese Latin Americans was wrong during World War II. The NDAA doesn't make similar actions the right thing to do today. The Nikkei community must become a leading voice in opposition to the NDAA because we know what was done in the name of national security and how it can play out. We know the human impact when our constitutional and human rights are violated in the name of national security. We know that holding the government accountable for wrongdoing is essential for the protection of our rights and freedoms and our democracy. Let's get our Nikkei community informed and moving. Please organize and support efforts, especially within the JA community, so we can learn more about the NDAA, how it's connected to World War II internment and the ongoing JLA redress struggle, how the NDAA affects our community, what are the key lessons from our own wartime and redress history that we should share with the rest of the nation, and what action we can take. Part two for our call of action is demand government accountability. Get redress for the Japanese Latin Americans. Not finding justice in the United States, the JLAs brought our case to the international community in 2003. The Inter-American Commission on Human Rights agreed to review our petition, a petition to hold the U.S. government accountable for the ongoing failure to provide the JLAs redress for war crimes. War crimes. That's the level of severity of what our families were forced to live through. And it's considered to be an ongoing war crime until properly redressed. We've been waiting almost 10 years for a ruling from that commission. What's taking so long? Well, we're going to be taking a community delegation to Washington, D.C. to find out. We'll also be visiting officials of Latin American countries to make sure they know that their own citizens and residents were victims of a U.S. rendition scheme during World War II. We want to make a public appeal to the Commission to issue a favorable ruling this year. The U.S. government accountability for ongoing war crimes against the Japanese Latin Americans. This is part of the unfinished redress business of our Japanese-American community and this nation. This is living history unfolding and becoming part of the Nikkei community's legacy. We need your help to prepare for the trip, to raise money, to keep the public informed, and we invite you to join us as part of the community delegation. We put out this call for action because now is a time for all people of conscience to step forward to protect our democracy, to restore our Constitution, to uphold the rule of law, including international law. Now is a time for all of us to speak out and stop the NDA and get Japanese Latin American redress. Thank you.
Well, we still have almost a half an hour for questions and comments, so the audience is invited to raise their hand, and there's a microphone, which Eric has very kindly agreed to run over to you.
I'd like to ask Gray Shimizu, have any of the Japanese Latin Americans received any kind of redress at all?
Yeah, we, you know, we had five lawsuits and two pieces of legislation. One of the lawsuits is called the Mochizuki lawsuit, and that was filed in 1996. And the U.S. government offered us a take-it-or-leave-it settlement offer, which was very controversial. And in that, the majority decided to accept it. And because it was the first time, you know, that the U.S. government would acknowledge, you know, the wrongdoing. And that was important for a lot of our parents, you know, that they hear that apology before they passed away. But the why it's controversial is when you look at the apology letter, it doesn't mention Japanese, it doesn't mention Latin America, and it doesn't mention the scope of the violations. It's controversial because as monetary compensation for war crimes, they offer $5,000. And it's controversial because when they announced it to the public so that, you know, our people who are living who knows where, it was a one-day announcement in a newspaper in Japan and a one-day announcement in a newspaper in Peru. So, but we still felt it was important that we get on record that there was some acknowledgement by the strongest country in the world that they acknowledged that a wrongdoing had been done, and that we then we switched our strategy to the legislation. But unfortunately, after all these decades, we find that we have no justice in this country for the Japanese Latin Americans, and that's why we go to the international community as a last resort.
Ichiro, this question's for you. Where did the term kibe, I know it's from kaeru no ki, but where did kibe, that term, come from? Do you know the origins?
Well, it means that the return to the United States. I guess the official term is kibe nise. It had been used widely since the 1930s. There was actually a movement by the community to bring back that Nisei in Japan, the first group of Nisei who had been kind of thoroughly Japanized, right? But in the 1930s, that the many communities in California especially wanted to bring them back. First reason was that no more immigrant could come to the United States from Japan after 1924 because of the racist sort of immigration policy, right? But then, so that population is kind of shrinking, and the Filipinos are taking over the Japanese farms as a kind of sort of workers and also the tenants. So that, you know, the Issei farmers actually wanted to have those fresh sort of a Japanized Nisei with U.S. citizenship to come back to their countries. And so that movement was called the Kibe Undo. So, you know, so that since that time, I guess that the term had been used widely in the United States.
We should say it's not a universal term. In Canada, the word for that population was Kika.
Hi, I was very interested in what you were talking about, the Japanese that got stuck in Japan and ended up in the Japanese army. One of my close friends from college, his father was just interviewed by NHK twice about the same situation. He was stuck in Japan, and he ended up in the Japanese army, even though he was a Nisei. So that was something that I never heard about before. What is the number that you think were ended up in the Japanese army?
A number?
The number that ended up in the Japanese army that were Nisei.
There's no statistics because they are conscripted as Japanese nationals.
I see.
So, you know, nobody can tell, actually. So, yeah, I don't know.
But, okay.
And also that, you know, there are quite different groups of Nisei, right? The first group of Nisei I talked about estimated 40 to 50,000 during the 1930s. They are technically Nisei, but they usually identify themselves as Japanese because they are thoroughly Japanized, right? So, you know, if you include those people, you don't even know how many.
So, 40 to 50,000 seems awfully high to me. I mean, as soon as you said it, you know, two or three times, I said, God, that seems very high because there was only 120,000 that went to the camps. So you're talking about a third of the people went back to Japan? Sounds a little high.
Well, because that most Issei actually came to the United States not as permanent settlers, right? A lot of Dekasegi workers. And probably over half of the Issei, I think, eventually returned to Japan with dollars and so forth they made in the United States. So if you go to like some places in Yamaguchi or Wakayama, you actually run into people who were born in the United States. They don't call themselves Nisei, but, you know, they're the kind of people I'm talking about. They're Japanese, but they talk about, hey, you know, I was born in the U.S. My parents actually worked in the mines in Utah and so forth. There are a bunch of those people actually in like Hiroshima, Yamaguchi.
I see. I have another question to Grace. What about the Japanese that were brought here from Latin America and came to the United States, and when they stayed here, what is the percentage of those people that went back, or do you have any numbers that went back to Latin America?
It's kind of hard to tell. Initially, you know, people wanted to go back to their homes in Latin America, but the governments wouldn't let them come back initially. And then also the U.S. had a policy. They wanted to rid the Western Hemisphere of these enemy aliens, and that's why they deported, you know, the majority of the Japanese Latin Americans to Japan. There were about 300 that were able to fight deportation, mainly because of, I don't know if you know the attorney Wayne Collins. He helped them to fight deportation, and most of them then stayed in the United States. We heard that maybe about 100 were able to finally go back to Peru. But, you know, those that were sent to Japan during the hostage exchange and those that were deported at the end of the war, you know, some of them eventually, you know, gained the money or the connections to be able to come to the United States or to go to Latin America. But, you know, that took a long time because, you know, they went as very displaced peoples, you know.
Oh, going back to the other thing for just a minute, it was kind of funny because my friend George, for a few years, his father was, he didn't have any country because they took away his U.S. citizenship because he was fighting in the Japanese army. But they said, well, your son, even though your son was born in Japan, we'll let him have an American citizenship, but you still can't have yours. So I just thought, he just told me about that a couple nights ago. I thought that was very funny.
Just to say that in terms of what Ichiro was talking about, the people who went back, there were also people who went to Hawaii and went back. So if you're comparing the Japanese population, the population of Japanese Americans to the population of people who were born in the United States and went back with their families, if you compare it to all of the population in North America, it's a much smaller percentage.
Grace, what was the total population of Japanese in Peru before the war?
It's about 60,000.
Oh,
compared to Peru's population, it was fairly large, although after the race riots in Lima in 1940, a lot of people left.
And then how many were interned? Just a portion of that. 60,000 didn't come, did they?
No. Peru, was about maybe 1,600 or so. We tried to figure out, I don't know if our math is right, 1 in 10 or something, or one. I don't know.
That sounds large. It's maybe 5 per 5%. The point is just that the U.S., if I may speak as a historian,
sure.
The U.S. Told the Latin American countries, which were, by the way, not even at war with Japan at that point, that if you have any troublemakers or people, we'll take them away. And so the Peruvians were only too happy to get rid of their Japanese competitors, especially after the tense situation in Lima, identified people who they said were troublemakers without any due process, any proof of anything except the desire of somebody to get rid of them. And by sheer coincidence, a lot of them were landowners.
Yeah.
Oh, and then one other thing. Did any of the 1,600 or whatever, did they accept the $5,000 that was offered?
Yeah. In total, there were like over 2,200 people from 13 countries that were, you know, interned. And by the time, you know, of the redress, we know that maybe about 800 filed for applications, you know, and like that. So we'd say maybe something like 900 and something people, either through the Civil Liberties Act or through the Mochizuki, you know, were able to get redress. But there were about 17 people that opted out of the Mochizuki.
I guess I'm jumping ahead here, so someone else.
Because Janet has been, now that we've been patient.
I have two questions. Was there any contact between the people who, quote-unquote, chose to be, quote-unquote, repatriated to Japan during the internment process and the Kibe? And then, Franklin, can you say something about the military and their role in preventing large numbers of Japanese Americans from being interned in Hawaii?
Well, don't really know for sure, but I think both populations, because of their language skill, were desired in occupation, so they could find job opportunities in that respect. And then there was a contact with the the Nisei from the U.S., like, you know, linguists and so forth as well. So it was a kind of strange situation where that loyal Japanese-American soldiers and also the former disloyal, right? And also those strandees kind of working together in occupation, so to speak.
Well, maybe Greg can help me out here from the Washington side because he studied FDR and the war years. But my understanding from the military governor, the military in Hawaii, was that they really could see that removing all the Nikkei from productive service over half the farms, for example, in Hawaii, not just the sugar plantations, but the people raising vegetables or fruits or animals for food were in the hands of the Japanese Americans, and over half the really critical construction technicians, carpenters, masonry, iron workers were of Japanese descent, stevedores. So the whole war effort would have been really badly impaired had they all been removed from service. So the military understood that it was in their it was in the interest of the country and of the military effort in the Pacific to keep the Japanese at work, the Japanese Americans at work in. But, you know, my understanding is that for quite a long time into 1942, Washington was still trying to get General Emmons and the military in Hawaii to comply.
Great. Yeah, that's absolutely right. I would add that as a historian of martial law in Hawaii, that there's also a sort of Machiavellian element that the military could use the fact that the Japanese Americans were at large as an excuse to hold on to martial law. Franklin mentioned that it lasted almost 3 years, and the fact that the Japanese Americans were free meant that the military, particularly General Greene, who was responsible as the chief executive officer on the Provost Marshal Generals for issuing the orders that ran the military government, could say, well, there's a threat, so we can't have civilian elections because then we'll have Japanese Americans elected and they can't be trusted. We can't have must have military tribunals because we can't have regular juries because then there'll be Japanese Americans on the jury and they can't be trusted.
This may be an irrelevant question for you, but I would love a response nonetheless. I was traveling in Buenos Aires, and it was interesting. There was a Japanese cultural garden there, and being Japanese, I figured I'd go see what they had. And it was very curious because the man there was speaking Spanish. His name was Jose Yamamoto. And I kept blinking my eyes, and I was curious, what are you doing in your library at this botanical cultural garden? And they were doing the same thing we're doing in this country. They were getting the old newspapers from their Issei and Nisei generation. They were trying to get the history of their people in that country. And the same thing was happening in Brazil. And I really wonder how many Japanese left Japan to go to Mexico, Brazil, Peru, the United States, Canada. Why did they leave? And I know that across all of Latin America, they have an annual conference, or they did. Is that still continuing?
You're speaking of the Pan-American Nikkei Association, and the Japanese American National Museum sponsored an encyclopedia of Japanese descendants in the Americas, for which our distinguished panelists furnished the article on Japanese Americans. But well over a million Japanese went to the New World, first mostly to Peru and mostly to the United States and Canada, and then when the United States and Canada particularly closed its doors, they went to Mexico, to various Latin American countries, and especially to Brazil, which to this day has the largest Japanese American population outside of Japan, Japanese population outside of Japan. And why they left? Many, many different reasons. Why do immigrants ever leave? The economic difficulties at home, the promise of a new life, family in the new world, evading draft in Japan. Don't laugh. A lot of Japanese Americans came to the United States to avoid the draft, which puts on a rather ironic stand on Japanese nationalism in the 1930s.
I have to tell you, my mom, who passed away last year, was born in Colorado. And so she, her family took her back to Hiroshima in the 20s. And in the 30s, as a teenager, she didn't want to stay in Shobara in Hiroshima, in the boonies at that point, at that time. Now it's a big city, you know. So she, my uncle, I remember him describing her leaving the village, walking with her suitcase to the train station to leave for good. And he says she never looked back. But so she landed in Honolulu as an American citizen, but for some reason the immigration folks were not about to let her disembark. And it turned out that FDR, she says, was vacationing in Honolulu and issued an executive order, which is still really interesting to me, Greg, because he was so virulently against Japanese Americans. He really thought they didn't belong in the United States. But he issued an executive order allowing that boatload of people to disembark, which was interesting because she had, when she was rebuffed by immigration, she then said, "Well, I'm not going back to Shobara, so I'm going to go on to Brazil." but as I said, she was allowed to disembark, met and married my father, and in gratitude, she named her firstborn son Franklin.
We have time for about two more questions.
Oh, Grace, I think you may know my sister-in-law. She's a proven Japanese. Chico Felicita Kato. But anyway, she just passed away a couple of years ago. But Wayne Cullens helped their family remain in the United States, and they got the full American redress, $20,000. Another incident that she told me once was when they were brought to the United States, they were put in a big warehouse, spread eagle, you know, legs spread, arms spread out, and sprayed with DDT. Yeah, that was something.
I volunteer at the Japanese Museum, and I know we're seeing a lot more interest amongst the Japanese who come to visit us about the story of the Japanese Americans. And it's like it was a buried story for decades, and then all of a sudden, from Japan, they're really interested in, you know, the 99 Years of Love miniseries and what really happened to the Japanese Americans. And I'm wondering, is there anything you can attribute this to? Is it the expanding media worldwide, or what caused that within the Japanese population? If you want to answer.
Actually, it's that the Japanese in Japan had been always sort of interested in the success story of Japanese abroad. Since like 1940, Japan actually hosted the world, huge conference for the overseas Japanese, including the U.S. Issei and Nisei as well, to celebrate them as the frontline fighters of Japanese expansion overseas. That's 1940, okay? But then after the war, right after the war, actually during the occupation, Nisei were actually celebrated as a sort of model for New Japan because they are democratized Japanese, right? As opposed to these imperial Japanese, right? And then, in the bubble years, Japanese are also Japanese Americans and also Japanese Peruvians with that, president, right? He was everywhere in the media. But, all those things oftentimes serve as some kind of sort of ideological weapon, so to speak, or mechanism to show up the pride of Japanese or pride of being Japanese. Look at those overseas Japanese as successful, people. We are, excellent, sort of a superior kind of thing, right? So sometimes that there is some sort of a kind of side, political sort of a thing attached to that the Japanese interest in the especially success of overseas Japanese, including Nisei and Sansei.
I just want to make a commercial advertisement that at the next session, which is the closing session, Professor Masako Ino of Tsudo University is going to be talking about the impact of Japanese Americans on Japan.
Thank you. I'm Masumi Izumi from Doshisha University, and I'm have a question for Professor Azuma as a Japan-based scholar of Japanese American history. And you mentioned that there were a considerable number of the people who returned to Japan, Issei's and also the Nisei's who were sent to Japan or who voluntarily went to Japan and got stuck in Japan during the war. And I've been researching and doing oral interviews of the Japanese Canadians. Well, I shouldn't say Japanese Canadians because they're settled in Japan. And when I'm doing the interview, I get the feeling that they thought places to work, basically, not necessarily trying to immigrate to Canada or immigrate to the United States, but they saw all these other villagers were going to a certain place in Canada, so that naturally they went as part of their life, but they didn't necessarily consider themselves as leaving Japan forever, and a lot of them come back. And so what we're doing in Japan, finding out, is that we've been incorporating history of Japanese diaspora people, and including people who went to Asia and people who went to North and South America and Hawaii and other places in the Pacific, and we are thinking of how that excavating that history changes the history of our perception of Japanese history, that Japan has had diverse experiences. It hasn't been this people who are stuck in the archipelago of Japan. So we've been thinking about how that history changes the perception of Japanese history. But you said the returnees should be included into Asian American history. But I just want to ask you, how would that affect or change the perception of Asian American history?
Well, relating to that, I guess, sort of Japanese American history. For example, I just used the Japanese Latin Americans, right? They're excluded from redress deal because they're not American citizens in a way, right? And they're illegal aliens because they're kidnapped and brought over here without passport, right? So, that the idea of civil rights or constitutional rights, I mean, that's important everything. But if you stick to that, then you actually create the boundaries from which to exclude a lot of people, right? Based on the legal status or, you know, and so forth, right? Then, you know, Japanese Latin Americans wouldn't have a place because they are not American citizens, right? And then these, you know, strandees who lost their American citizenship because of their military service in Japan or the voting in the foreign election, you know, they're not American citizens, so they're, and they also, they kind of belong to foreign country. So, but, you know, but as I mentioned, I think that I made it clear that they are still part of the Japanese-American history and so forth, right? So I think that, you know, by including all these people, I think we can sort of think about the meaning of citizenship and then how we sort of measure that, understand the community membership and community formation in a very biased and restricted way, right, so to speak, right? So, you know, and then you can sort of question that kind of nationalism that we have here, and then the kind of oppressive nature of community making the Japanese America had engaged in by excluding a bunch of people. And your anger actually has to do with this exclusion. And we should know that there are people who are angry at the way in which that the community has been formed and then, you know, embrace certain form of ethnic identity as the only way of being Japanese American. And then that anger I actually share as well as a post-war immigrant. I'm never part of this history that you embrace. So, you know.
That's right. Thank you very much.
And on that angry note, I think we have a run out of time. Thank you so much for attending. A round of applause for us. For our lovely contestants.